So the title of my talk is 22, or Neon 22 and White Dwarfs, and I want to talk about the effects of this particular minor species on the cooling and touch upon potential seismological effects. And just for sake of interest, this is a picture of a planetary nebula, NGC 2440, and in the center is a white dwarf at the very early stages of its existence. And so most of the talk is going to be concerned with what happens from there. And how does Neon 22 come into play? So, a very sparse outline is I want to talk quickly and review the basic properties of white dwarfs and the basics of their evolution. Then get into Lars and my work on Neon 22 diffusion and liquid white dwarf interiors. This is going to occupy the bulk of the talk. And then Neon 22 and white dwarf seismology. We'll be talking about at the end and a brief summary of what we've worked on and some areas to which we can springboard off of. So white dwarfs in synopsis. And I should say, I'm going to be talking about in this talk about carbon oxygen white dwarfs. I'll just leave it at that. So nothing exotic like magnesium or helium. Actually, heliums aren't too exotic. So basically the mid-range vanilla white dwarfs which are the end products of stellar evolution for stars in the range of about one solar mass up to about 5 to 8, depending on who you ask. So the basic property of white dwarfs are the fact that they're an electron degenerate object. So their pressure support is degenerate electrons. And in the densities over most of the white dwarf, the electrons are semi-relativistic to relativistic. The ions come along and form either a Coulomb liquid or a crystal depending on this parameter of gamma, which measures basically the ratio of the electrostatic energy to thermal energy for the ions. For gamma greater than 1, you have a liquid. For gamma around 173, most you have a end up forming a Coulomb crystal, where A here is just the inter-ionic spacings. So the electrons provide the pressure support. The ions hold the thermal energy for the most part of the star. So 98% of the star is carbon oxygen. 2% is 22 neon. And this is the bulk of the star. There's a thin layer of helium and then hydrogen. Occupying basically a degenerate shading into non-degenerate envelope. Let's see. And the story of white dwarf evolution is the fact that it shines through loss of its thermal energy, more or less. So we'll get into that. So some rough parameters for typical white dwarfs are there. Okay. So how do white dwarfs evolve? I.e., basically it means how do they cool, since they haven't got any remnant thermal, any nuclear energy or anything along those lines. Okay, so the basic approximation to white dwarf cooling was worked out by Mistel in 1952. Summary of his assumptions that go into this derivation or calculation are shown here. I'm really not going to run through it. The main point is the fact that there is a relationship between the central temperature of the star, and I should say that the core of the star is isothermal. Basically because the heat transport within the interior of the star is via degenerate electrons, so it's highly conductive. The envelope is basically energy transports via radiative transport. So you have a very efficient conductor on the interior surrounded by a thick insulating layer. And so the core is, for all practical purposes, isothermal.
Yeah, I knew it.
I'm sorry. Okay, so short and long of this, the point of this is the fact that you can relate the luminosity of the white dwarf to its core temperature. And also you can relate the core temperature to its age, and via that, if you know its luminosity, you know its age in principle. Okay, the simple relationships here don't hold in general because there's more things going on than just the simple cooling law and these assumptions, several of which aren't really valid.
But the basic point is that if you can measure the luminosity, you can infer the age, assuming, obviously, if you have the cooling theory correct. Okay. Yeah, sure. So the point of it is that I have electrostatic energy. That's fun. Okay, so just a brief comparison between more modern treatments in the simple Mistel relationship. So here, shown in the dashed line, is just the simple Mistel power law relation between luminosity and white dwarf age. And then the solid line and the dotted line are relationships calculated by Althaus and Benvenuto in 98 for the typical low mass 0.6 solar mass white dwarf and a higher mass 1.0 solar mass white dwarf. Just for sake of comparison, let's see, what do I want to point out here? Two things. First off is that there's more things than just the power law going on, obviously, in the M2 realistic calculations. And second off, the higher mass white dwarf does what you expect it to do. It has more thermal content and so stays hotter longer, brighter longer. But then you sort of cross over, and I'll get into why that occurs later on in the talk. The red dots here are just to indicate the rough luminosity range over which white dwarfs that were born at the start of starting time of our galaxy would be. Let me rephrase that, because this folds in the main sequence lifetime of the progenitor stars. So anyways, stars that were born at the beginning of the galaxy should have white dwarfs, so white dwarfs in this luminosity range are going to be the dimmest white dwarfs you could produce from a star born at the beginning of the galaxy. Does that make sense? I'm not really rephrasing it right. All right. So why is that important? Because you can play the game of, well, go out and measure the dimmest white dwarfs or get a sample of white dwarfs in the galaxy. Yeah. No, those red dots represent, I'll answer the question in this one. Okay. So what I'm showing here is the luminosity function. So basically, the number of white dwarfs per luminosity bin measured in our galaxy. So these curves are theoretical calculations that take into account the evolution of mid-sequence evolution of the progenitor star, the white dwarf evolution, and integrated over all masses and luminosities and ages. Okay. So you get these curves basically saying, for a given set of models, this would be what the white dwarf luminosity function should look like at 14 gigayears versus 8 gigayears. Okay. And this is data from a local sample of white dwarfs in the galactic disk. So the masses of the white dwarfs, the faintest white dwarfs, are the most massive white dwarfs produced. The main sequence lifetime of the most massive stars, which produce the most massive white dwarfs, are the shortest. And also these actually end up cooling the quickest by that luminosity age. Okay, so the point of this is the fact there's a sharp cutoff at some luminosity for white dwarfs in the galactic disk, which is interpreted as basically being the imprint of the fact that the galaxy hasn't existed forever. Okay. Yes? For the most part, these are complete surveys. I'm not an observationalist. So what that means in terms of how they go about making sure that they've got all the white dwarfs of this particular. One of these is basically a parallax study. Proper motion study. So you pick all the white dwarfs with up to a certain proper motion to get white dwarfs out to a point, a certain radius from us. So that's okay. And via those selection criteria, these observers claim these are complete samples. Is that sufficient?
Well, I'm not an observer.
Right. however they make that determination, I haven't found a good explanation in the papers I've read over as to why this is complete.
Are you asking, should you believe the data?
mean, the observers believe that they've corrected for any incompleteness they have, right?
Well, that's really what I'm asking, because when you see precipitous decline in number of faint objects,
right.
Could be caused by incompleteness.
Fair enough, yeah.
And the correction is tricky, because it's just when you're running out of objects.
Yeah. And I want to show this one. So yeah, here's just because I put it together. Here's just another way of doing a similar thing. It's not quite as formal, in the sense that basically what you're doing, the game you're playing here is find the oldest object. So this is all the data from one of those samples that were binned up, showing white dwarfs in mass versus effective temperature. And these are white dwarf isochrones, the solid lines being the isochrones for only taking into account the white dwarf evolutionary times. The dashed lines, the same age isochrones folding in the main sequence progenitor times. So if you go and look at white dwarfs that are on the oldest isochrone, you get an age for the galactic disk of at most 11 giga-years. I should say that this plot was intended to be a representation of what you can do with white dwarf cooling entropy to get it right, in that these isochrones were calculated with a pure carbon white dwarf models, which basically will give you the oldest age estimates you can come up with, because these have, so the carbon, basically it's a question of thermal content. If you're carbon versus 100% oxygen, you have more thermal energy because you have more ions floating around for the same temperature. So it takes longer for carbon to cool, carbon white dwarf to cool compared to a pure oxygen, because you have more energy to get rid of. Okay.
So we all need to step back for a minute.
Yeah.
I mean, I think this is the way to do it, right? When you get masses and see effect is for each separate one, right? And you put a point on the plot, and you ask where does it sit relative to it. I mean, this is better than looking at some luminosity
function. Right,
Well, luminosity functions, they've gotten rid of mass. You don't see the mass. And here you can see the mass, and you're much more reassured that there's not some funny business going on. So.
Okay, so getting back to how do we move past the simple Mistel cooling? Well, obviously we have to take into account other sources and sinks of energy, and some are listed here. What I want to focus on is chemical redistribution. In other words, basically mass transport or redistribution of the chemical abundance within the star, and how that can be a source of energy. And since we're talking about ages, the thing of importance is basically for a given release of energy, however it's accomplished, what's the increase in the age of the white dwarf? And that can be approximated via an integration of the energy per unit mass released over the white dwarf divided by the luminosity at that time. So the brighter you are for a given release of energy, the less you incur a delay. Whereas if you release the same amount of energy at a later time where the white dwarf is dimmer, you increase its inferred age by a much greater extent. Okay, so actually let me put that back up, because I want to say, okay, so what I'm, chemical redistribution, okay, fine, well and good, how does that happen? The original idea in the context of white dwarfs was a process called fractionation, whereby during the crystallization of a star, if you have a mixed composition plasma, the relative abundances in the crystalline versus the fluid phase are not necessarily the same. And so typically, or generically, you get a density differential between the liquid and solid phase. So the liquid or solid phase, depending on which is actually heavier, and it does depend on the composition, will sink or rise, or sink and rise. And that leads to, so let's say, for example, the solid is oxygen rich and it happens to be denser. Okay, the oxygen rich solid will sink, the liquid-rich carbon will rise, and you'll get a net segregation of oxygen versus carbon. So that's one way of separating. The same process involving neon 22 has been looked at in the context of energy releases. And what Lars and I have been looking at is not the fractionation process, but what happens if neon 22 just sinks on its own. And I'll get to why that might occur.
Chris,
yes.
that last formula, don't you have to worry about Dalton Hill with the heating source?
This is sort of instantaneous. The heating?
Or delta over the integral of L continuous.
So in other words, integrate over the entire lifetime of the star, is what you're saying?
You don't have to do that necessarily.
Or just over an... Yeah, like I said, this is a pro... if you do that, you get the wrong units though for delta T, don't you? Because this is energy per unit.
I think I can get the units right.
Okay, I'm sorry, I'm apologizing, but, so, but this is, okay.
And you're assuming you know L.
Right.
That epsilon.
So epsilon is an instantaneous release of energy at that time, given that. So this is an integral over the mass of the star, obviously. All right, sorry, I don't mean to be insulting. So the way to look at this is the instantaneous increase in the amount of time the star is going to live. Due to an energy release at this time. Okay, so if you want to talk about the total increase in the star's lifetime over a release of a certain period of time, then yeah, this is not the correct thing to say. But disintegrating DL doesn't work, right?
I'll show you.
Okay, so first off, I want to talk about the macroscopic fields in white dwarf interiors, because this is really where the difference between carbon and oxygen in neon 22 is most easily seen. So in a white dwarf, we have, at the very least, a gravitational field. So the force on a nucleus of a mass number A, given by Bloch. And there's also an electrostatic field that in the context, or in the case of a degenerate plasma, the force on a given charge E is given by 2 mpg, and this just follows from hydrostatic balance. Okay. So for carbon and oxygen, both have an A of Z approximately equal to 2. Okay. And so the macroscopic force on these ions is about 0 in hydrostatic balance. Whereas for neon 22, which especially because it has an extra 2 neutrons to its 10 protons. So it's, has an A over Z that's slightly larger. Okay. So just about the note about the production of neon 22. It comes from this reaction, which occurs during the helium burning phase of a star's life. And the key point is the fact that there's a beta decay in the process, leading to an overabundance of neutrons. Okay. And since all the CNO catalysts end up as nitrogen 14 at the end of the hydrogen burning phase, and subsequently all of this nitrogen 14 gets processed into neon 22, the initial metallicity of the star basically ends up being the final mass fraction of the white dwarf in neon 22. So for a solar metallicity object, you get a mass fraction of about 2% of neon 22. So, and if you go through and just look at the two forces on a neon ion, there's ends up being a force of 2 mpg downward on a neon 22 ion. Okay. So this biases the diffusion, or just random walk of a neon ion downward in the star. Okay. So, how do we get energy out of chemical redistribution? Well, you think of several things. Since carbon and oxygen are buoyantly neutral, right, there's no macroscopic force on them, the only thing you're going to be able to extract is the fact that there's a difference in the electrostatic interaction between two oxygen versus 2 carbon, and vice versa. So redistributing carbon and oxygen in the star can lead to a change in the total Coulomb interaction energy in the star. So order that. Whereas displacing a neon ion, in addition, leads to basically this gravitational potential energy being released. So just looking at some typical numbers, and let me focus on just these since they're the total integrations over the star. If you completely segregate a 50-50 carbon-oxygen plasma, you release about 6 times 10 to the 46 ergs in the process. Whereas complete sedimentation of neon 22 in, it should be, I should have quoted this, I believe this is a 0.6, so a typical salt white dwarf, is roughly the same amount. So these are competitive processes, potentially. Okay. Of course, this amounts to getting all of neon 22 into the center of the star, which may or may not be possible depending on the assumptions you make. Okay, so for comparison also, the thermal energy content of the same mass white dwarf at 10 to the 7K is about an order of magnitude larger, and another important process, latent heat release, is about the same order of magnitude. So these are all potentially of the same importance. So like I said earlier, the first process posited as a way of moving neon 22 around is the same fractionation process as the less exotic carbon oxygen fractionation. Unfortunately, the results of how you do this, the results of considering this effect really depend on your treatment of the problem. Originally, the first thing that was done was the easiest thing to do was treat the carbon oxygen plasma as basically, or the carbon oxygen neon 22 plasma as an effective binary mixture. So basically treat the carbon oxygen ions as a single ion and put in neon 22. And when that's done, you actually end up basically moving all of your neon 22 into the core, releasing a lot of energy. And so getting delays over the entire process upwards of 3.4 gigayears, which is, depending on the mass of the white dwarf, about 30 to 40% of the age of the white dwarf without this process. So it's not a small effect. Whereas doing the full-blown problem where you consider carbon, oxygen, and neon 22 as separate ions, it's found that you actually get a oxygen and carbon fractionation occurring first. And by the time you start seeing neon fractionation occurring, you've already formed a massive oxygen core that prevents neon sedimentation or segregation into the deep interior. So you don't release a lot of gravitational energy in the process. So which one's right? I don't know. This one, technically, if it was done correctly, and there's not been a follow-up on calculation by anyone that I know of, so this is basically just one shot and come out and that's been the last word, whether or not this process is competitive or actually can do much, it remains to be seen, or what actually is the right number, I should say. So there is, though, another way of moving neon 22 into the core of the star, and that's the work that Lars and I have been working on, and that's through sedimentation of neon in the liquid interior. So as we said, there's a macroscopic force on neon ions, and so the neon ions tend to sink. Okay. So what Lars and I have been doing has been looking at this and considering what the effects of this process would be. So to characterize these effects, we just modeled simply the evolution of neon 22 via a continuity equation, right, where the flux, or this current, consists of both a diffusive piece and a drifting piece. So in the absence of composition gradients, you just end up getting neon falling at some viscous, some sedimentation rate set by the viscosity of the fluid. So if we know D, we can determine what this drifting flux or drifting velocity will be by a comparison of diffusive equilibrium and hydrostatic balance. And it turns out that this is what you come up with. So basically, if you know D within the confines of this model, then you know the neon current. Okay. So how do you get D? Well, there's several ways we can do so. The key being the fact that no one's done an appropriate microphysical calculation of this problem under the conditions of a strongly coupled plasma. So what we've done is make a best guess at what it should be. There's several ways one can do this. One can utilize the viscosity of a one-component plasma to calculate D via the Stokes-Einstein relation, or one can utilize the Monte Carlo calculation of the self-diffusion coefficient of a one-component plasma. And this is what Bilston and Hall, the work that I've been springboarding off of, utilized. And so this is what we took. I should say that these two, well, I'll just say this in the next slide. These two agree within, you know, about 20%. So there's definitely some room for improvement as far as nailing down what D actually is.
If you said A,
I'm sorry. AP would be the neutral, basically in the this formula, AP serves as the particle radius, which in the context of this would basically be the effective size of a ion in a plasma. So sort of the neutral charge radius would be an effective approximation for that.
So can you say just a few words about how those two differ in terms of physics?
Let's see. So this comes... Right. Yeah. This one, I can't really speak to other than the fact that it was a Monte Carlo simulation result. This one comes from basically I can go through the derivation later. I'm not going to remember off the top of my head, but basically a.
Well, it's eta, that's the only thing.
Right. And so eta here comes from the Monte Carlo, another Monte Carlo simulation. So these are sort of competing. Numerical simulations that get the important parameters here.
There's always been the question of fluids, does Stokes-Einstein work as a measure of self-diffusion coefficient? So what's a little bit strange in the one-component plasma literature is people have done both calculations of eta and BS, but only about 15 years later did someone ask if these two give you the same number. And you know the answer to within 20-30% is negative. You don't always very near the liquid crystal, very near the liquid solid transition, because what ends up going in that D in the basement is more of a correlation length rather than particle size. So it's the standard we expect. You get a divergence of all the diffusion coefficients when you become solid. So it's remarkable that in liquid argon, for example, that gives you the right diffusion coefficient, so about 10%. Where A is the size of the atom on the atomic scale.
And the C of degenerate electrons plays no role.
In this? No. In these, well, in this, the OCP, the electrons are modeled as a static uniform background. So it's not really dealing with, like you're saying, dressing the particle. So. The rotation and... Off the top of my head, I couldn't tell you. So we haven't looked at that. White dwarfs typically are slow rotators, in some sense.
How slow are they?
Yeah, that's a good question. I haven't actually found those numbers. Okay. Let's see. So we doing? Blah, blah, blah. All right. Everyone happy so far?
Yes.
Okay. So the neon evolution is governed by the continuity equation. The thermal evolution, we model by considering the luminosity of the star, the luminosity generated by neon diffusion or sedimentation, L sub G, and then consider the latent heat releases. And the luminosity generated by neon 22, we just basically take as the integral of the work done on a neon 22 particle over all the particles. Okay. And then a key point is once the star is crystalline, we assume that the diffusion rate is just so small that you can neglect it in the crystalline portions of the star. So in the crystalline portions of the star, we halt sedimentation. All right, so this is where the last astro seminar I gave, we had to stop. It took so long. So this is hopefully new stuff to most people.
I'm curious now. So you mentioned that you use Patekhin Chabrier's results for heat capacity.
Yeah.
So what do you use to equate that state? Just as a general electron?
Yeah. It's not self-consistent in that respect. Yeah. That's actually next project is getting a realistic equation of state. So, okay. So if we evolve self-consistently the thermal, the temperature of the star in the neon density profile, this result is typical of what we get. At t equals zero, this line should be straight across. We start out everywhere with a mass fraction equal to 2%. And so it evolves from a straight line across into these curves, with the curves moving inward as time progresses. Two key points is one is that the main result is the fact that there is a depletion in the outermost portion of the star of neon 22. Okay. In that as the star crystallizes, you see at the crystal liquid interface this rapid jump in neon concentration. And I'll get to that in a second. So this is a result with, since we don't know D well, what we've done is parameterize our calculations. How should I say this? Done calculations with varying d to parameterize and get a sense of the effects of a varying diffusion coefficient on our results, obviously. So that was for the lower mass weight dwarf. Let me keep this out just so I can have some comparison. I don't think I'm going to be able to overlay them well. Okay. If you do the same thing for a one solar mass white dwarf, these, again, similar qualitatively, although quantitatively, you see a much more rapid depletion of neon in the outer layers of the star. And also, since the star is much more dense, the star crystallizes much more rapidly. And so early on, you already see the fact that the crystal boundary is moving outward of the star. By the time we've gotten to 5 gigayears, it's pretty much completely crystallized. So this more or less is the final neon profile here. Okay. All right. So just to, it's a quick, I mentioned that there's a increase at the liquid crystal boundary of neon 22. And the reason for that is basically the fact that neon, when it hits this crystal boundary, starts piling up. It's sort of like running in, the way I think about it in some sense is a snowplow moving through and pushing stuff ahead of it, or if you want to think of things falling into a impenetrable boundary, either way. And from a very simple model, you can get actually the density increase, the relative density increase at the boundary is equal to the diffusion rate of the neon ions divided by the rate at which the crystal boundary propagates out. And the way you can calculate that is just the amount of neon flowing into this interface, which crystallizes over a time delta t. So the crystal boundary moves from here to here over this time step, is just equal to the density just above this, neon density just above this layer, times the fall velocity times that time. Okay, and then you can calculate the increase in neon in this boundary layer via that quantity, and you end up calculating this. So it's a nice little relationship between the two speeds which you can get at relatively easily in the density increase. And here is just a plot of both the theoretical curve calculated from V over V Chris, and then actual measurements from our simulations. And they line up pretty well. So. Okay. So that's the sediment or the neon profiles. What about the cooling? So let me focus on the left-hand side first. This is a plot showing the gravitational luminosity, the power of neon generated by neon sedimentation, as a function of core temperature over the cooling life of the star. So up top, we show a 0.6 solar mass white dwarf. The top line, or the solid line, is for pure carbon. Dashed line is for pure oxygen. This one is for 5 times the normal diffusion coefficient, and this is the normal diffusion coefficient, DS, which was that Monte Carlo calculation, direct calculation of the self-diffusion coefficient in the one-component plasma. Here, as for sake of comparison, shows the luminosity of this particular model as a function of core temperature. So there was a question as to whether or not neon sedimentation could power a white dwarf luminosity for a period of time. And so far in our calculations, even with cranking the diffusion coefficient way up and the high mass of stars where you expect the effect to be greatest, it just doesn't happen. You do get significant imprints on the higher mass models early on, and I'll talk about that in a second, but just you don't get enough luminosity out. Okay, so this dot dashed line, as I haven't mentioned up to this point, is the calculation, or what you would get if you assume the star does not crystallize. There were some squawks concerning white dwarfs not crystallizing but entering a super cooled glassy state back in the mid-80s, if I remember my dates correct. And this hasn't really been looked at in the literature. So if you assume that the star doesn't crystallize but you just enter a glassing state, diffusion still occurs, albeit at the transition point once you actually see a large increase in your viscosity. It decreases, but it doesn't stop. And so these are the, or this shows the luminosity generated from neon sedimentation in those cases, taking a fit to the one set of calculations done for the viscosity of a glassy plasma. Over here is another basically cooling curve plot, again for the lower mass and higher mass models. Okay. And so the two things, how do I want to point out? First off, the dashed line here, for the sake of comparison, is the model without any additional heat other than just the thermal energy of the star. So this is based no latent heat, no neon sedimentation, basically. This is as fast as you can go in the context of the particular model that we have. And so this first solid line is the same thing, but without, or with latent heat added, but no neon. And then these lines, 1, 2, and 3, are with neon diffusion at a rate set by our fiducial DS, and then 5 times and 10 times, okay, for sake of comparison. And in the lower mass star, you end up seeing increases in the cooling age throughout this luminosity range, up to the point basically where the star has completely crystallized, which happens about down here. The dotted line is the result of diffusion with this glassy model.
Why does the glassy transition release less energy than
just the normal? Release less energy? Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, that's confusing. This is for nitrogen-14 white dwarf, as opposed to a carbon or oxygen. The carbon one sits up basically here and then dies down. So this was for sake of, I ran these models for sake of comparison with these, and I'm sorry, these are, yeah.
Why does the nitrogen-14 white dwarf might undergo a glassy transition without carbon?
No, I'm sorry. I basically ran one glassy model, and I did it with a nitrogen white dwarf, which so I could compare them to these curves, which all of these are nitrogen. This is just, I'm sorry, that's a bit confusing. So these are showing the range of potential outputs between a pure oxygen, pure carbon. And in the context of the single ionic species models that we've considered, we've run things with the more realistic nitrogen 14 model. Okay, so I'm sorry, that I probably lost.
Nitrogen 14 is to avoid doing a mixture.
Yeah.
We don't want them to turn into liquid nitrogen. So it's just think when he says nitrogen 14, think 50-50 carbon oxide.
Mean ion.
I don't think so. Okay. So, in the lower mass models, the neon diffusion process starts out slow, but it's enduring, and you end up incurring semi-significant, especially in the higher diffusion rate models, by late times. The lower or the higher mass models, the diffusion starts out rapid, but because of the crystallization process, is not able to go on for that long. And so the overall delays incurred actually end up being about the same for these two mass stars. But you see a definite significant difference in the overall morphology of the cooling curves between these two. Okay. So higher mass models are rapid, but short duration. Lower mass models are slow, but they go on forever, basically. Okay. So, and to illustrate this, this is a plot of the accumulated delay in cooling time for these models shown in this earlier, the cooling time, or the cooling curve plot. So the solid lines represent the increase in age at a given luminosity over and above the model without any neon diffusion, okay, for the D equals DS 5 × 10 ×. Here, the dot dashed line is the same for the glassy model. And the question, first question people are gonna ask is why you have this bump here, is the fact that in the glassy model, there's no latent heat released. And so during the time latent heat is released, in the other model, you actually delay above and beyond what the glassy model is doing. And then once you're done crystallizing, the glassy model delays take off. So same thing down here for the higher mass model. And again, you see this definite cutoff in the diffusion luminosity contributions as the star finishes crystallizing. The effect over here is that in that the cutoff occurs at earlier times for the 10 and 5 times the normal diffusion coefficient isn't due to crystallization that's occurring down here, or complete crystallization. It's due to the fact that the neon is sedimenting out of the outer portions of the white dwarf where most of the luminosity is generated so rapidly that you no longer have anything to sink before it crystallizes. Okay. And then for sake of comparison, this dashed line shows the delays incurred above and beyond the Solaris et al. 2000 models without carbon-oxygen fractionation. So these are the, or this is the incurred delays due to CO fractionation in someone else's models. So you can see that for higher diffusion coefficients, neon diffusion actually wins out. And in the, let me just leave it at that. Whereas, if not, so the diffusion, what the diffusion coefficient actually is matters as far as the relative importance of these effects on the overall cooling of the white dwarf is the point of that.
Like,
yeah. Right, 5, 10, 1.
Yeah, so, how much variation do you really expect? In the real world.
Yeah, right. Real world comparison, you get data that you actually compare to constrain it. But my understanding of people who actually do this is that there's a factor of several to many. So order, yeah, in the diffusion coefficient in these strongly coupled regimes. So 10 might be probably pushing it, but 5 is probably not unreasonable. What's the sign of that change is the big question. Do you expect it to be more sticky or less sticky? And I don't know. All right. If it's more, then yeah, we've got something that's important. If it's less, then yeah, worry about something else probably. All right. So that's the extent to which I want to hammer on cooling. And then, as promised, I want to get to pulsation. So there are white dwarf variables that are interpreted as being G-mode pulsators. So G-mode basically being gravity modes. In these oscillation modes, the restoring force is gravity. Basically, you can think of it as buoyancy. If you raise a fluid element up, it'll have an adiabatic density change. If it's more dense than the surrounding fluid it finds itself in, it will sink. It'll overshoot and start oscillating, assuming you can pump energy into the modes. Okay, so the typical frequency of these modes is the Brunt-Weissler frequency, and basically just given by a comparison of the density of the background fluid versus the adiabatic expansion. Okay, in a degenerate plasma, the density differential is going to be due to two pieces. One, due to the fact that, let me just say it this way. In the absence of composition gradients, net T equals zero. Do I need to go into this for everyone? Most people here probably know this, right? So.
Well, I never understand the compositional gradient.
Okay, that's fine. I don't want to bore people. That's fine. So at T equals zero, right? Thanks, Aristotle. At T equals zero. Gotcha. Okay. So forget about the T equals zero. Let's go to T equals zero and have composition gradients, right? Let's focus on, in the context of what I want to look at, gradients in the mean molecular weight of the material. Okay. Remember that the density at a given pressure for a degenerate electron gas depends on mu e. Right. Okay, so if I take a fluid element that has a different mu e and move it up, at a given pressure, it's going to have a different density. Okay, that's the source of the additional buoyancy. And for mu e gradients, actually, where they exist are about an order of magnitude in most situations greater than this change in the ionic pressures due to T. So where this exists, this can call the shots. Okay.
Okay. So the presumption is that you're in a very, very
In a very degenerate.
And the only change in and the scale height of the change in electron pressure is huge compared to the scale height change in,
Yes. Exactly. Right. So this can be. This is a small correction in a very degenerate gas. This can be. Relatively larger, equal magnitude, relatively larger for reasonable mu e gradients. Okay, so if you go through and do the calculation of what you expect the Brunt-Weissler frequency to be in the context of only thermal contributions and only mu e contributions, not worrying about ionic composition changes, this is what you come up with, where h here is just the pressure scale height. Okay, so. I want to start by looking at the left-hand plot again, and this is a calculation of the Brunt-Weissler frequency in a 1.0 solar mass white dwarf composed of pure nitrogen 14, showing the dot dashed line is that thermal contribution piece, and then the solid line, or these dashed lines, are the neon, or the mu e gradients contributions for diffusion coefficients equal to 1 in 5 times the normal diffusion rate. So what we did here to calculate this was determine what the neon abundance profile would be at the time the white dwarf enters what's known as the Zz-SETI instability strip, which is where these stars start pulsating, or this is a thin range and effective temperature at which these stars are pulsators. So the kappa mechanism. So you can see that over a portion of the star, the neon contribution is actually important. And then down here is an approximate integration of exactly the effect. H over R. Basically, the effective the frequency of a mode over the entire star. So you have to do the integral of the Brunt-Weissler frequency over the star. This gives you the mode periods. So that's a approximation, you can see that the neon actually comes into play. I'm sorry, the integral of this, I'm saying this entirely wrong. The integral of this is the mode. Basically gives you a first approximation to the mode period. Okay, so then an actual real honest goodness calculation with a real model by someone who does this stuff for a living, Paul Bradley. What this is a comparison between a white dwarf model that he has with the addition of the diffusion or the neon abundance profiles that we would calculate for given diffusion coefficients, again, 1, 5, and 10 times. So let me walk you through this. Shown up top are the original mode periods he calculates for his model absent neon, okay? No neon in it. So this is the L equals 1, 2, and 3 angular node numbers verse and K being the radial order of these mode periods. So boom, boom, boom. Okay. Then down here for L equals 1, 2, and 3 is a relative change due to neon contributions with a diffusion coefficient. Triangles equal 1 times their diffusion coefficient. Squares equal 5 times, and should be hexagons equals 10 times. And so there's some scatter, and there's some potential that the fact that these modes have not been identified correctly. So what we might think is a K equals 20 might be a K equals 21 mode, or vice versa in some of these cases. But the point of all this is the fact that we get up to 6% or so in some of these change. So for mode periods, let's just make it easy. At 100 seconds, 6% amounts to, if I do my math correct, 6 seconds, right? Okay. Sometimes I'm not so sure about myself when I'm talking in front of people. So that's a huge change that can be easily measured by, easily measured observationally. So this is something that, if it's real, it should be observable. And it's, yeah. Yeah. I wouldn't worry too much about that. The bigger thing that to go after is the carbon oxygen. So most white dwarfs aren't magnetized, and you can tell. Rotation, again, relatively slow. Again, I need to find those numbers as opposed to just trusting people.
Days.
Days.
Rotation in magnetic fields, you know, that's what I was going to say, they break the degeneracy in the
head.
And so they give rise to the characteristic multiple patterns, not just frequency shifts.
So in other words,
the frequency shifts are being higher.
Well, wouldn't the rotation split the frequencies? Mm-hmm. We were talking about that the magnetic field would actually change. I mean, if it's strong enough, and given at a given K, it would actually dictate what the modal structure is.
Yeah, right. The magnetic field is actually symmetric. It splits. The splitting is even then, as opposed to the top of each of them, which is all even. So that's one way to distinguish magnetic from rotational splitting.
We should give people a sense for the accuracy to which many periods are measured.
Right. So they're quoted to hundredths of seconds, and some hundredths of seconds in some papers I've seen. So this is not a small effect. So it's definitely measurable.
At the modeling level, rotation magnetic fields aside, there are other ways to get several percent.
Yes.
Shifts, presumably.
Exactly. So the question being, can we separate out the effect of neon from other things? The most, or at least the most sought after, I think, right now, is the carbon oxygen abundance. There's been several papers out recently, or soon to be out recently, where some modelers are claiming that you can go through, find the periods, do your calculation, and then do fits. And actually extract the carbon oxygen profile from the white dwarf via the mode periods. Okay, so if that being the case, that's interesting because that could and can constrain the alpha capture onto carbon 12 to oxygen 16 rate, which is sort of one of the big uncertainties in the whole helium burning phase. And so that's of interest. Whether it can be done or not, but the thing is that, okay, so then The point that I would want to make is that, okay, well and good, but if you're trying to do that, there's also this you have to take into account. How to entangle that, that's a trickier question. So yes, there are other things that are important. But the point of this is just the fact that you have to pay attention to this. Right? I think it's the only one, I think.
It also looks at the level of 2% is pretty sensitive to your fusion coefficient.
Yes. So that's another thing is that if you can set, so it'd be nice if you can separate out all these effects, can you get a constraint on D from this? Don't know. Okay, so that's actually ending on time and all I wanted to talk about. There's some things in here that I forgot to edit out, so that I didn't talk about. So I'll either blithely ignore those or you can ask me about them and I can answer. So basically, the inclusion of neon sedimentation order changes the weight over ages order 5 to 7% for reasonable values of D. If you pump up the diffusion coefficient, that can change it up to over 10%. Okay. And the interplay between sedimentation and when crystallization occur and white dwarf interiors determines at what time and what extent those increases actually happen. So it's definitely mass-dependent effects, obviously. And so the future work that we are thinking about is refining the cooling models, characterizing the seismology more fully of neon 22, and then potentially exploring the effects. This is why I didn't talk about neon 22 sedimentation nucleosynthesis in type 1a supernova. The point here being the fact that if you have neon-rich isotopes laying around in the outer layers of a star when it blows up, the overabundance of neutron-rich isotopes that are formed is going to be affected. And then characterizing the mass and luminosity for...
Why is that important for the outer layers of the star or not? That's basically gold.
Right. I think the point is that most of nucleosynthesis occurs from the outer layers. Again, I'm speaking beyond my expertise. So this is what I've read. I don't understand. I haven't dug in. It's too wide. It's the case.
So well, you know, all iron, most half of the iron in the universe is made of type 1a.
Right.
So you've got to get the iron isotopes right. And you've got to worry about the isotopic production of iron.
Yeah.
And what makes that, there's two ways you, so naively you'd expect iron 56 from the decay of nickel 56.
Right.
But there's two ways you can break that. One is that the neon, any neon around, excess neutrons.
Yeah.
And that those excess neutrons then make determine the isotopic ratios of iron. The other way is that in the deep interior, you have a little bit of electron captures, and that can also break the neutron-proton ratio. But if you have models with and without neon at the outer edge, you get very different iron isotopes.
I see.
So it does affect the iron isotopes you make. So there's a lot of this question of metallicity effects in type 1a. If you actually read those papers in great detail, what you'll discover is, what they really mean is neon 22 abundance. When they say metallicity, what they really mean is neon 22.
So the big observational push from all of this is the fact that to test this, there's two avenues. One is actually constructing cooling curves, if that's possible, which we believe it will be, for open cluster white dwarfs. So you look at an open cluster, you see a sequence of white dwarfs, and you can get the mass and luminosity of those white dwarfs, then you can construct these cooling curves. And the morphology of the cooling curves definitely will be different. Actually, let me rephrase that. I should say, you have to construct the isochrones for a given white dwarf, or for a given open cluster. If you get enough open clusters, whose ages you believe relatively well, and you believe that white dwarf production mechanisms are more or less the same across those clusters, and we can start doing the game of actually constructing these cooling curves. And so the morphology definitely will be different depending on what processes are going on. And so that may be one way of actually constraining whether or not neon diffusion occurs and how fast it happens, versus also just checking, believe it or not, whether or not white dwarf cooling and general is even close to correct. You know, it's not been done. So that's one avenue. The other avenue is actually these pulsation mode studies, placing constraints on D. So hopeful that one or either of these will be a methodology where we can actually have a sanity check on any of this. So that's all I wanted to say. Any questions?
The pulsation mode studies tie in with the degree of sedimentation mode. In other words, does the pulsation profile change depending on how far the sedimentation process has progressed?
Pulsation profile in sense of the actual eigenmodes, or I would assume so, but I haven't looked at those or done those calculations, so I don't know. Yes?
Coming back to this question of gravitation, it seems like the electric field would be a function of latitude because you have the effect of gravity is a function of latitude. So the rate of diffusion is also a function of latitude.
Could be, yes.
And so the rate of energy release would be a function of latitude. So the question is, could you drive significant,
possibly, but again.
I think the question is how much does the rotation change the gravitational equipotential surface from being purely spherical?
Right. So, off the top of my head,
there.
So Lars says about order days.
Days.
We're talking about seconds of a day square.
Yeah.
Fuck this.
Yeah.
So your answer would be no.
Well, no, the effect is we're there, but it's at the level of 10 to the minus 10. Well, could the electric field adjustment, the electric field difference is 10 to the minus 10.
What's b squared over p gas at this surface?
Depends on the white dwarf, but most white dwarfs are not magnetized to any extent. So. And
about 5% of white dwarfs have magnetic fields above 10 to the 5 Gauss. That's about it. They all come from AP stars. It's true.
Is there any help with measuring surface neon?
Surface neon abundances? I don't believe so, because you're also, you're shrouded, so there's a remnant layer of helium and hydrogen on top of white dwarfs, of portions of the star that didn't undergo helium burning. So those layers, yeah. Okay.
So next week, I